A few years back, following a stressful season of ministry, a friend of mine in the church offered my wife and I the use of his sailboat. We were going to spend about a week sailing, and so Lynn and I very excitedly boarded a plane and flew south, landed, took a cab to the harbor where he keeps his boat, loaded up all of our supplies, our clothes on the boat, started the engine, threw the dock lines off. The minute I put the transmission in reverse and started to back out of the slip, I could tell something was wrong. The boat didn't seem to be as responsive as I had remembered it being. After we got out of the slip, I put it in forward and started motoring out of the harbor. There wasn't much wind that day, so we had to motor over to the first island we were going to stay by. And I remember thinking, something just doesn't seem right. We should be going faster than we're going. And then I looked at the gauges, and I could tell that we weren't turning as high RPMs as I remembered this engine could turn. And then I looked at the temperature gauge and started to watch it go up. So I did what every qualified mechanic does in a situation like that. I went up and I thumped the gauges. You know? Didn't change their reading at all. And a little later, as we continued to motor, I thought I smelled something awry in the engine room, so I had Lynn take the helm, and I went downstairs and I looked, and sure enough, I could tell things were getting hot in the engine room. And just as we were coming into the island where we were going to stay that night, a hose, one of the water hoses, like a radiator hose, blew apart. And I thought, oh, now we have trouble. And so we stayed there that night, and of course, overnight, the engine cooled off, and I tried to replace some of the water in it, and we managed to sort of cripple it back to the original harbor where we called a mechanic. The mechanic came down. He said, yep, you have trouble. I'll fix the radiator hose. So we fixed the radiator hose, and he said, now everything's fine. We started up. As I was backing out of the slip, I had this uneasy feeling. It was like, you know, Murphy's Law of what happens on vacations, you know. I don't think everything's fine. This thing feels the same way to me. Put it in neutral, and then I put it in forward, and we started heading out the harbor again. I yelled back at the mechanic, could anything else possibly be wrong? He said, you might try diving over the side and checking the prop. If it's got barnacles on it, you're in trouble. We got halfway over to that island again. Sure enough, tack isn't reading high enough. Temperature's going up. I stopped the engine. We hoisted the sails. Just a little bit of wind. Sail to the island. Dump the sails. I get on my snorkeling gear. I dive over the side. Sure enough, I see it. 2 inches encrustments of performance-crippling barnacles all over this propeller. No way that it could spin properly through the water and propelled the boat the way it was designed to do. And so I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll find the only tool I ever learned how to use in the home of my upbringing. So I went into the galley and I got a butter knife. And I spent the next 2 hours taking gulps of air and going down 5 feet under the water and chipping away the barnacles on that propeller until I had it all clean. And then the next day when we took off, the motor ran beautifully. I mean, it performed just like it's supposed to perform, low temperature, high RPM, no blowing hoses. And as we were going to the next island, I thought to myself, what if I hadn't been alerted to the problem of performance robbing barnacles on the propeller? This vacation could have been a nightmare. Because I could have kept blowing hoses and overheating this engine, going back and have a mechanic say, I'll fix the hose, and everything will be all right. What if I hadn't learned about the root of the problem, which was far under the surface of the water, that required quite a bit of work to get at? Step 4 in the 12-step process is all about those performance-robbing barnacles that are going to have to be scraped away at the root of your life if you're ever going to heal up and grow the way God would have you grow. You know, we're in this 12-step thing, and we started at step one when we all admitted that we have a problem of some sort that's making our lives unmanageable. Let's say that someone's problem was chronic overspending. And it's just making your life unmanageable. It's got you in the weeds time after time after time. You say, that's my problem. Step two said you're going to have to come to the point where you believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity. And last week we said we're going to have to turn our will over to God as we understand Him and cry, help, help. Now step four says you're going to have to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of yourself in order to get at that collection of character defects that produces that overspending problem. Because if you just kind of keep going at the overspending problem, it's like fixing a broken hose without addressing the collection of barnacles on the prop that's going to recreate the scenario over and over and over again. Step four says, you got to go deep. Your problem isn't just what you called it. That's the outgrowth of this seedbed of character defect that we all have that tends to produce the problems that make our lives spin out of control. One time in the history of God's people, a deceptive pattern emerged in the lives of His people. You know, God would bless His people, and the people would say, yay, God. They'd go out and dishonor God in their worship, their relationships, their finances, their ethics. And so the prophets would confront them and challenge them to tear their garments as a symbol of repentance. And so the people would go, oops. They'd tear their garment a little bit and then go right out and repeat the same sins that they'd been doing. And this would go on and on until one day a prophet named Joel confronted the people for their sin. And he shouted at the top of his lungs, this time God is asking you not to tear your garments. This time God is saying, I want you to tear your heart. Because you can just kind of keep tearing those t-shirts. It's not solving the problem. You got to do heart work. Got to go a lot deeper. Reverting to my metaphor, you got to stop thumping gauges and fixing blown hoses. You got to identify and list and label and deal with the root of the problem, which is far underneath the surface of the water. Step four says, I'm ready for that. Step four says, I'm tired. I'm tired of thumping gauges and fixing broken hoses. I'm tired of spending more time in the harbor with a mechanic than I am out sailing like I want to. So I got to ask you, friends, this is a tough one. Do you have what it takes to grow? Do you have what it takes to go the next step and take this searching and fearless moral inventory? I think some of you do. I think a lot of you do. And that's partly why I love and respect you as much as I do. Because a lot of you are, you know, just wanting to grow, waiting to be challenged to go the next step. So that's what we're going to do. Let me tell you how you take the fourth step. The originators of the 12-step program for alcoholics suggest taking a world-famous list of character barnacles and working through that list slowly and carefully and honestly, and then comparing your life to that list. This provides at least a starting point for your fourth step. From there, once you get the hang of how to do a fourth step, you can go at it a number of different ways. By the way, do any of you know what famous list I'm referring to? Yeah, I heard someone whisper it. It's called the List of the Seven Deadlies, the Seven Deadly Sins. 500 years ago, a dedicated band of religious leaders, after years of human observation and involvement, declared these seven defects as the maladies most likely to be at the root of most of our problems. So the 12-step experts often tell the four people at the fourth step, just start here. You can get fancier later. but just start here. Do a first pass. Familiarize yourself with what the seven deadlies are all about, and then find out how many of them are encrusted on your propeller, creating problems in the engine room. Think them through, write them down, journal a paragraph or two on the ones that you can identify that are undermining your life. Own them, contemplate the price you and others have been paying for these defects. Take the time to feel the pain that these defects have caused you and have caused other people in your life. But two rules are necessary. You're going to have to be honest. And you're going to have to be thorough. Step four is not about trying to resolve anything. It's important that you know that. Step four isn't about curing these problems. Step four is about admitting these problems. And for some of us, that's huge. Some of us are like the guy on the video who said, I would be terrified to just admit. The writing it down part is extremely important. Seeing your character defects in print underscores the reality of these defects. When we just say words, oh yeah, I mean, I got a problem or two. I mean, don't we all have problems? I got some, you got some? That's one level of admitting. Another level of admitting is taking out a spiral notebook and getting the pen or pencil out and saying, here is the truth about who I am. As the list develops page after page, when you see it, when you write it, when you reread it, when the list grows, your denial system is going to weaken. And you're finally going to feel like you've been honest before God. Now what I'm going to do these next few moments to help you with your fourth step is I'm going to walk you through the seven deadlies for the purpose of acquainting you with them, and also to kind of get the ball rolling so that you know how to use this list if some of you are going to do the fourth step this week. Now you can take notes or you can get the tape, and probably better to get the tape so you can listen to it later. But let me run through these, and should it surprise any of us that pride leads the procession of the seven deadly sins? It shouldn't surprise you, because pride is often called the basic breeder of human difficulty, the biggest obstacle to human healing and growth. No wonder the Bible contains as many warnings about it as it does. No wonder Jesus bristled every time he saw it manifested in someone. Pride. Any of you have it growing on your propeller? And if you just said, who, me? Pride? Your denial's working really good. Slow it down. Pride comes in many variations. It starts very early in most of our lives. Pride is what motivated us to fire God in the first place and place ourselves in the CEO seat of our existence, which was the beginning of the end for us. Pride motivated us to put ourselves at the center of our world, to try to control everyone in it. Pride is what motivated us to project an image of adequacy and super competency and self-sufficiency, which tends to push other people away from us and make them feel small. But no matter if they feel small, pride makes us feel big. And that's what counts, that we feel big, bigger, better than the people around us. Done much image control lately? Done much image management lately? It's pride driven. Pride is what motivates us to deny or discount the seriousness of our wrongdoing. Someone helps us see an obstacle, a defect in our life, and go, oh, well, you know, Jay, all of us have a little nuance here or there. We discount the seriousness of the flaws in our lives. Pride will keep many of us from actually doing step four. Pride is what powers up our justifying machines and our blaming machines. This is the subtle side of pride. Pride whispers to the overspender, well, you deserve all the good things in life, and besides, you only have 3 credit cards backed up to their limit. There are loads of people in a lot worse shape than you. You're not doing so bad. Pride whispers to the overworker, you're just one of the few remaining fired up workers in this country's workforce. And you do Tokyo proud. You're not the problem. Pride whispers to the controller, if you don't organize and orchestrate everyone else's life around you, who will? It's your civic duty. It's your Christian duty. Straighten out, everybody. Pride whispers to the drinker and the adulterer and the pornographer, you can stop whenever you want. You can stop whenever you want. There's no problem here yet. Don't panic. Pride whispers to the wealthy, the poor don't deserve any more than the squalor they live in because they aren't willing to work like you work. Pride whispers to the wrongdoer, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's that bozo boss of yours. It's those parents of yours. I mean, it's that misfit mate that you marry. It's that crowd that your kids are hanging out with. It's not your fault. Pride turns the best of us into blaming buffoons. We can't see it. And pride pleads for us to stay strapped in the CEO seat, even if our lives are caving in and our relationships are breaking down. Pride says, don't give up yet. Ever hear the tantalizing whispers of pride? Got any pride barnacles growing on your propeller? I do. Just recently, a close friend said to me, Bill, sometimes I fear the only teacher you really listen to is pain. I knew what he meant. You see, humble-hearted people learn easily from a wide range of teachers. Prideful people cast off a lot of good counsel because they know better. They know better till they hit a wall at 60 miles an hour, and then they grudgingly admit that they missed one. Something slipped by them, this one rare time. Meanwhile, people all around them are shaking their heads and wondering, why would anyone be so proud? You know, when you're doing step four, those of you who have what it takes to grow, start with pride. Ask yourself, how does pride manifest itself in my life? Why can't I agree to just be a person among peers? Why do I project myself as better than, smarter than, sharper than, richer than, more handsome than? Why is that so important to me? Ask yourself, what am I denying? What am I justifying? Who am I blaming as a result of my pride? The mere admission of pride will catapult you in the direction of healing and sanity and growth. And if you want to do a little extra credit on this one, peel pride back a little bit and see how much of it is actually motivated by fear. Why don't we admit the truth about ourselves to some of our friends? Because we're fearful, we're scared stiff they'll reject us. Why do we blame other people instead of say the truth about what's going on? Because we're terrified at how awful it's going to feel to be responsible and wrong. You know, Jesus referenced one time, he said, two people prayed. One guy stood up on the street corner and he said, oh God, am I glad that I'm not like the riffraff. Am I glad I got my life under control and, you know, you help a little and I'm glad I've solved my problems and all that. And Jesus said, the other guy couldn't even look up and he just said, oh God, I've got some major problems, major character defects. Please have mercy on me. Help me. Jesus said, be like the second guy. The next of the seven deadlies is anger. The serious kind. 12-steppers call it resentment. Stored up toxic anger. Any of that growing on your prop? Are you aware of it? Don't say no too quickly. You know, in college, I owned the world's smartest dog. You got a pride thing buzzer going off? I'm still working on pride. Okay. Now, nature got even with me. I believe now I own the dumbest dog. But the dog I had in college was so smart. I could teach it all kinds of tricks, but my favorite one that I taught him was that we lived, some of us guys in college lived, rented a space under a doctor's office, and it was sort of on the main drag of the town. And a lot of townspeople would walk by on the way to work and on the way back, and we'd sit out on the step with this little dog as all the townspeople would go by, and he was real friendly. We didn't have to keep him on a chain. He'd go up and be real friendly to all the people. But most of us college students didn't like the mayor of that town very well because he had strict curfew laws and he enforced them. And the mayor walked by our house every day. And so I think on a $10 bet, as I recall, I taught my dog to growl at the mayor. It was really slick. He could pick the mayor out of a crowd. You know, there'd be three or four people walk by and the dog would wag his tail and be all happy. The mayor would come and he'd lay his ears back. And I'd show that to all my friends, the girls that I dated and everything. I'd say, watch this. We'd all sit out on the steps and watch this dog do that. Then my crowning achievement was I got the dog to be able to growl when I merely mentioned the mayor's name. He'd be happy chasing a ball or something, and I'd say, Mayor so-and-so. And he'd look all around. What a dog. Whose name could I mention right now that would make you lay your ears back and start growling in your spirit? Who are you mad at? Who are you seething with resentment toward? And you might not even be consciously aware of it until you take a fourth step and slow your life down and say, whoa. Whoa, it's true. Where did that resentment start? Is it ever going to end? Was it all someone else's fault? Did you play a part in it? Whether you realize it or not, this particular barnacle called anger or resentment is major trouble. If there's any of this barnacle on your propeller, you're going to lose performance, guaranteed. You're going to overheat and you are going to blow hoses. Which is why the Bible tells us so emphatically in the book of Ephesians that we're studying on Wednesday and Thursday nights. The Bible says, deal with your anger before the sun goes down, because if you let it go underground and store it up for a long enough period of time, it's going to distort every relationship you have. It's going to affect your attitude throughout the course of the day in ways that you're not necessarily going to be aware of, but other people are going to see it and feel it and sniff it and be pushed away by it. Resentment is serious business, much more serious than most of us think. And the fourth step says, you gotta take some time to list the resentments in your life and get them out and admit them. It takes honesty, courage, humility, and time to do it. But if you could just admit that to yourself, you will unlock a growth door that's been sealed up for years. And again, the fourth step isn't about trying to resolve it right now. It's about admitting it. And this is particularly hard for dedicated Christians who say, oh, but it's a sin to be angry, so I probably don't have any of that. You probably do. And it's probably hurting you in ways you aren't aware of. So, when you deal with this one, who are you growling at? What's making you foot stomping mad? How many resentment barnacles do you have growing down there? And you realize the effect it's having on your life. The third of the seven deadlies is greed. In our culture, this one can be difficult to discern because it's so common. But how many of us have wrenched our lives out of shape in order to attain more than our reasonable share of life's goodies? I remember talking to a stressed out businessman one time whose marriage was at risk and his kids were at risk and his health was at risk. And he was bemoaning his pace and schedule and pressures, and I asked him why he was living at the pace he was. And he said, because business is great these days. I've got 6 deals that I think could all go our way, and if they do, we're going to hit the jackpot. And I said, I think under a leading from God, I said, what if you were to try to only reel in 2 of those deals? Would that be enough to keep your business on dry ground for a while? And he said, well, yes, but why settle for two when I could do six? He was absolutely oblivious to how he was wrenching his whole life out of shape to go after more than he even needed. Another businessman I talked to one day, I knew he was a stockbroker, not from this church. He was at a place where I used to work out. And we used to talk about his stock trading all the time. One day I see him, he's got his towel around his head, he's got his head in his hands. I was thinking he must have had a bad day on the stock market. And so I sat down next to him. I said, what's up? And he said, Bill, tell me. You're a minister. Tell me. He says, I have a system. So I've worked it for years. If I just go downtown Chicago, show up, put in my 6 hours, I can make $5,000 a week. If I just show up, pay attention to business, I can make $5,000 a week. $250,000 a year. No problem. He says, problem is, I can't do that. I got to shoot for 8, then 10, then 15, then 20. And sometimes I hit it, and then I have this horrendous crash. I remember him looking right at me. He said, what is wrong with me? I said, greed. It's greed. A lot of us have it. We wrench our lives out of shape to get more than sometimes we even need. Now, some of you are going to look for this barnacle, and you're not going to find it. You just don't have it in your life. Others, maybe a little bit. But some of us, if we're honest, are going to admit that this particular barnacle, mixed in with a little pride, has caused a lot of heartache. Ask someone who has had to live with a greedy spouse. Ask a child who has watched his mom or dad devote his best energies to the acquisition of yet another piece of seldom-worn jewelry, or another car that isn't used that much, or a home, or another toy, and they'll say, it's nuts. And the person doesn't even see it. But if you work the fourth step and you go through the seven deadlies, you might stop at this one and you might say, maybe that's me. And you can write about it. You can admit it. The fourth one is lust. Lust. Now listen, it's going to get very quiet in here. And don't move. Shift around in your chair, or someone's going to think you have the problem. Okay? For the last couple of weeks, we have been voyeurs watching Mike Tyson in action. We saw the videotapes of Mike hanging around the Miss Black America pageant, propositioning woman after woman for sexual favors. Not a relationship, you understand, just a romp in the hay. I'd say Mike Tyson wrenched his life out of shape, due in part, anyway, to lust barnacles on his propeller. But now let's just not keep peeking into Mike's windows. Let's look in the mirror. Lust is our normal sexual instincts gone a bit haywire. Lust is the lifting the sexual dynamic out of the overall context of a loving relationship and pursuing just that as an end in itself. Lust is the reduction of a whole person to a body to be played with for my selfish pleasure. And some of us know all too well how quickly lust can wrench our lives out of shape. Some of us have had to lie to employers and spouses and friends in order to sneak off somewhere to try to satiate our lust. Some of us have purchased magazines and rented videos, and we found out we're just making the problem worse. And after a good shaming party that we throw for ourselves, we turn around and do it again. Some of us flirt with people and make suggestive comments to people to assess the lust quotient in them. And we can't seem to stop it. Some of us date for lust. Some of us married for lust. Some of us ruin our marriages because of lust. Some of us ruin our lives because of lust. But strangely enough, most of us have never even sat down with a spiral notebook and a pencil and admitted to ourselves that we've got lust barnacles attached to our propeller and it's wrecking our lives. We're terrified to admit that our sexual instinct has left the normal healthy range and lust is driving us to behaviors and ways of thinking that are slowly destroying us. I have to remind you what Lee said in Scripture. Healing can't start until you admit that you have something that needs to be healed. And you're not going to surprise God with this information. He knows. He's just whispering, admit it so we can start the healing process. Admit it. Step four calls out and says, come on, no more denial, no more hiding in the dark over this. God knows our frame. He's aware of our fallenness. Let's just admit it. Step five is envy. You all know about envy, don't you? There's a story told of a merchant who envied the success of his primary competitor in his town to the point where it became a near obsession. And one day a silver lamp genie appeared to this envious merchant and said, what do you want? I'll give you whatever you want with one caveat. Whatever you ask for yourself, I intend to give in double measure to that other merchant that you envy so much. And it only took the merchant a few seconds to reply, make me blind in one eye. And you say, that's terrible. And you're right. And some of us have that kind of defect growing on our propeller. And it drives us to obsess on someone. And it causes us to hyper-compete with someone. And it causes us to say destructive things about people. And it causes us to wish the worst for someone. If you ever catch yourself fixating on someone else's beauty or position or personality or accomplishments, please know that those aren't harmless daydreams. They pour toxins into the stream that runs underneath the surface of your life, and it often intensifies your river of resentment, and it feeds your lusts, and it exaggerates your fears in ways you aren't aware of. And envious people are hard to develop intimate relationships with because their envy causes a constant sense of uneasiness that distorts the relationship. You just can't get close because you know there's something else going on that's driving this person. And you can't put a handle on it, but it's killing you. It's killing the relationship. Anybody need to do a fourth step through some envy? Anybody willing to admit that they spend large blocks of time focusing on what other people have and what they're like? Fantasizing about getting it for yourself? Why not just admit it? Write it down. Think it through. Write about it. Figure out what's going on. You don't have to try to resolve it. Just identify it. Two more, quickly. The sixth one is gluttony, and the seventh one is sloth. Number six, gluttony. How about we skip over this one? Can we make a little pact here? We just skip over this one? If I agree not to talk about it, will you promise that you'll be real honest about it when you do the fourth step? You're noncommittal. All right, then let me just say this. Overeating can either just be a broken hose, by that I mean a symptom of a collection of character defects that's driving it, or it might be a barnacle in and of itself, just a flat defect where you want to consume more than the normal appetite would say is reasonable. But in either case, it is something worth paying attention to. And as many of you know, when overeating leads to obesity, there are usually landmines detonated all along the way. Landmines like shattered self-esteems and the loss of self-respect and the regular practice of self-shaming and serious health risks to boot. And that's all I want to say about it. If you promise to just write down, I have this problem. And I got to think about it. I got to own up to it. I got to figure out what's going on there. I'm getting to be a pushover. I let you off easy on that one. But the seventh one is one of the deadliest, and it's sloth. And I'll bet you're pretty sure there's no sloth barnacles on your propeller. You know, to live in this area, to afford a home, to support your kids, you got to work and work hard, don't you? Don't we all? Well, what we're concerned about with number seven is not just how hard you work, but what you're willing to work hard at. Another way of putting it, we're concerned that you might work hard at making a living, but fail to work equally hard at learning how to live. Some of you have never worked hard at learning how to live. How to live sanely and lovingly and responsibly and honestly in community with God and others. As hard as it might be for some of us to admit, some of us have what I call selective slothfulness going on. That is the knowing that a certain area of our life needs attention desperately, but we blow it off by saying, I'll tend to that tomorrow. And tomorrow never comes. So the destructive behavioral pattern goes on, as do the self-defeating attitudes, the crippling relational distortions, the troublesome character defects, the spiritual deceptions and sin. Now we go out and work hard at making a living, but we never stop, deal with our stuff, and learn how to really live. And what's worse, listen, what's worse is some of us neglect the sobering reality of preparing for our death and the ensuing day of reckoning. Tomorrow, the slothful man says, tomorrow I'll figure out how to get right with God. And the tomorrow never comes, but the day of reckoning does. And that's the price of slothfulness. Got any slothfulness barnacles encrusted on your prop? I don't know. Some of you are saying, I'm not sure. I'll dive over the side and check tomorrow. Well, I hope you will. Our time is gone, but I have to ask a general question now. And it's the title of the series. Do you have what it takes to grow? All heaven's cheering you on tonight. All heaven is cheering you on, saying, grow, grow, grow. Hear the chorus? Grow, grow, grow. And I think hundreds of you are going to come out, are going to carve out some time this week to do a fourth step. And as scary as it sounds, it's going to be worth it. It'll move you much further down the road to healing. Remember, spiral notebook, piece of paper, pencil, time. Be honest, be thorough. Get the tape, work through the seven deadlies. When you're done with the seven deadlies, just do some free thinking about what other stuff might be important that's crippling you, that's robbing your performance and sabotaging your relationships. But you know, there's an energy issue here. I learned some time ago, it takes the same amount of energy to stay in denial as it does to come out and expose my defects for healing grace. If you're not going to work the fourth step, you're going to still have to work to stay in denial, to keep shoving stuff down. God says, look, why don't you just take that same amount of energy that you would have invested in denial, and you know, that's going to cause the destruction of your life here and in eternity, and why don't you turn it around, and why don't you invest it in bringing it out in the light so it can be forgiven and healed. Let's stand for closing prayer. Our Father in heaven, once again, I want to thank you for the character and the courage of this congregation, for the willingness of seekers who don't even have a full grasp yet on what grace and salvation through Christ is all about, the willingness of seekers to continue to wrestle and seek and to keep these issues on the front burner of their lives. Lord, we all need to grow. And we all have barnacles under the surface of the water that need to be scraped away. Please give us the courage to carve out the time to do the fourth step honestly and thoroughly for Jesus' sake. Amen.